You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Italian Renaissance master Piero della Francesca died over 500 years ago on the same day in 1492, in fact, that Columbus first landed in America. But he's just now getting his first solo show in this country. The Frick Collection is exhibiting seven of his paintings, most of them from the altarpiece of the Church of Sant'Agostino in his hometown of Borgo San Sepolcro, in a show called Piero della Francesca in America. It's on view until May 19th, and I'm very pleased to welcome the show's curator, Nathaniel Silver, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Why hasn't there been a major museum show of Piero della Francesca's work in this country before now? Is it because so few of his paintings are located here?
That's certainly one of the reasons. The majority of those seven paintings that are in the United States are, in fact, at the Frick Collection, which made the Frick the ideal venue for this exhibition.
There is that Hercules fresco at the Garden Museum in Boston.
That's right.
Is that it?
The Hercules fresco, the four paintings at the Frick, one at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and the seventh at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown.
And many of his works were frescoes, so they are permanently in walls. And the other ones, kind of fragile, hard to travel?
Yes. Most of Piero della Francesca's work was in fresco, and of course fresco doesn't travel. His most famous work, The Legend of the True Cross, is in the Church of San Francesco in Arezzo. That's an experience that you really have to be there for.
I have, and it was a thrill for me, although it isn't always so easy to see the work. The church can be dark, and the sight lines aren't always so great, but still, just being in the presence of a masterpiece like that was thrilling for me.
It certainly inspired many American painters and collectors in the early part of the 20th century who made that pilgrimage themselves and really fell in love with Piero on the spot in Italy.
There's a portrait of St. Augustine from the Museo Nacional d'Arte Antiga in Lisbon. Was it important to include that at the show?
Yes.
It is a gorgeous painting.
It was an easy decision to make. How could you not want that painting in your exhibition? It's one of Piero's most glamorous figures, embedded with an incredible number of details. For example, the rock crystal crozier that he holds in his hand, which is completely transparent and you can see right through it. It's a really virtuoso statement as a painter.
And then he has a robe that is really made up of, it's like a tapestry of paintings.
It is. He has a lavishly embroidered robe made out of cloth of gold, the most expensive material available during the time of the Renaissance, embroidered with blue velvet brocade. And then, as you say, the borders of this robe are covered in tiny little scenes depicting events in the life of Christ. It's like a comic strip.
By the way, because the show has seven works, we have a slideshow on our show page with images of all the paintings in the exhibit, as well as views of the gallery installation, because the installation is an important part of the show as well. Ken, you give us a short synopsis of Piero's career.
Well, Piero was born in the small Tuscan town of Borgo San Sepolcro around 1412. He did his first training there, painted candlesticks, learned how to paint in fresco, and when he came of an age where he was looking to expand his repertoire, he moved to Florence, and we know that in 1439 he's recorded in participating in completing some of the most important fresco cycles that were being undertaken there at the time.
Because Florence at that point was the center of the Italian Renaissance.
That's right.
He could have gone to Venice, I guess.
He could have gone to Venice or Siena. That he chose Florence suggests the amount of work that was available for artists there at the time and the kinds of skills that a young artist, might be able to learn there.
Well, Venice is where Masaccio painted the first paintings that show perspective, real one-point perspective. And Piero was a master of perspective. Wasn't he even a mathematician?
He was. One of the fascinating things about Piero's career is that he travels all across the Italian peninsula, from Urbino to Rome to work for the Pope, from Ferrara to Rimini. He really works for some of the most important patrons of his time. It's like a who's who of the Italian Renaissance.
So he was famous during his lifetime.
He was absolutely famous during his
and
lifetime.
And didn't the German artist Dürer study his work and his writings?
He did. He was one of the most important writers as well. As you say, he wrote three treatises on mathematics during his life. Another artist who did that was Leonardo, for example. He also wrote on mathematics.
How did his reputation fare in the centuries after his death?
Well, he was certainly remembered in Borgo San Sepolcro, where he was from and where all seven of the paintings in this exhibition were originally made for. But like all artists of that period, he was forgotten over the centuries and then really rediscovered at the beginning of the 19th century. He was rediscovered by collectors and painters, by art historians, by museum officials going to Italy to look for paintings to fill the new National Gallery in London, to fill the Louvre in France, and eventually by Americans to fill the walls of their private collections in the United States.
Well, did that reflect changing tastes? Because for a long time, Raphael was considered the ideal, and Piero is not like Raphael.
No, it absolutely did reflect changing tastes. You're completely right. As painters began to re-engage with the 15th century and rediscover the works of 15th century masters, Piero really emerged as one of the favorite painters of this period, one of the most prized.
And then in the late 19th, early 20th century, critics started seeing similarities with artists like Cézanne and the other post-impressionists.
Absolutely. Roger Fry is a perfect example. He was fascinated with Piero, who he considered a proto-modernist. He identified in Piero's work shared interests of the post-impressionist painters, people like Cézanne, and Roger Fry wasn't the only one. Roberto Longhi as well identified similar shared features, which really brought him to the attention not only of scholars but of modern painters as well.
We're talking about the exhibit currently at the Frick Collection called Piero della Francesca in America with its curator, Nathaniel Silver. The show runs only until May 19th, although, as you said, four of the paintings in the show are in the Frick's collection already. How did the Frick acquire them?
They came from a range of different sources. The first one was acquired in 1936. It was brought before the Board of Trustees by Henry Clay Frick's daughter, Helen Clay Frick, who was very passionate about Italian Renaissance paintings, but especially about Piero della Francesca. She had been trying to get her hands on a Piero for many years. She even tried to buy one of the other paintings in the exhibition from its then owner, Robert Sterling Clark, and he said, no, absolutely not. So it wasn't until 1936 that she was able to find this figure of St. John the Evangelist for the Frick collection.
Well, we talk about them as individual paintings, but they had all been part of an altarpiece. And one of the saddest things for me is that so many of those great altarpieces were cut into pieces and separated as separate paintings, and only now we have to try to imagine what they were like. And in this case, parts of the altarpiece are missing, aren't they?
Absolutely. When we walk through museums today, we often forget that many of the early Italian Renaissance paintings we see so conveniently framed on the wall and separated were actually single fragments of much larger, more elaborate structures that would have dominated the room where we stand in a museum. And like in this case, Piero's Sant'Agostino altarpiece, there are eight fragments of what would have been a massive complex of perhaps over 25, maybe even 30 images. Only eight fragments survive today, and we have six of them in the exhibition at the Frick Collection.
At what point in his career was he when he painted this altarpiece?
He was really at the high point of his career.
So he's painting it in a small church, despite the fact that he's already kind of an art superstar.
He is absolutely a painter celebrity by that point. He has worked for the Duke of Urbino. He's undertaking his major fresco cycle in Arezzo, and he's, during the course of the commission of this altarpiece, called away to Rome to work on the Pope's bedroom. He frescoes the ceiling of the Pope's bedroom, unfortunately, which is lost today.
Now, wasn't it destroyed and painted over by Raphael, if I remember correctly? Changing tastes?
Absolutely, changing tastes. It's another example of changing tastes. It was destroyed, like many of Piero's frescoes, also like his frescoes in Ferrara for the Este family. wealthy patrons who could commission Piero to decorate their houses and their rooms could often hire many different artists, and tastes changed over time. So the works by Piero don't always survive.
Now, one of the paintings in the show, considered by many to be its centerpiece, is Virgin and Child enthroned with four angels, which has been in the which is on loan from the Clark Museum in Massachusetts. That's not from this altarpiece that these other paintings come from.
That's right. Six of the paintings in the exhibition are fragments of the Sant'Agostino altarpiece, and the seventh, the Clark painting, is a separate altarpiece. Unlike the Sant'Agostino polyptych, the Clark painting is actually an intact altarpiece. And the most immediately noticeable difference about the Clark painting is that it's a rectangle. This doesn't seem like a very big deal to us. We see rectangular paintings all the time in museums. But at that time, it would have been a novelty in San Sepolcro to have a single unified field to create the altarpiece in.
Now, that's the Virgin surrounded by angels. The San Sepolcro piece, she would have been surrounded by saints. There was a tradition called Sacra Conversazione in the Renaissance, where you put all these different saints together from different ages, and you surrounded the Madonna and Child with them.
The Sant'Agostino altarpiece is exactly that. It was, the center is lost. It was probably a Virgin and Child enthroned or a coronation of the Virgin, but surrounded by four saints, two of which are in the Frick exhibition, whereas the Clark altarpiece is the Virgin and Child enthroned surrounded by a formation of four angels, a very different composition, but one equally important for its devotional content.
But it also helps us understand what the other piece might have looked like?
It gives us a sense. It evokes what a Virgin and Child enthroned might have looked like at the center of the Sant'Agostino altarpiece, even if the two paintings were not originally part of the same complex, didn't have anything to do with each other.
In the catalog, you write that the Clark's curator allowed the painting to be unframed so you could study it. What did you learn from that?
Well, it was a wonderful opportunity, and we were very grateful to the Clark for taking it off the wall and unframing it for us. One of the things that struck me immediately was just how big it is out of its frame. For an altarpiece that's only about 2.5 feet high, it's in fact enormous, and you lose a little bit of that with the modern frame that is on it today. We were also able to look at the surface of the painting very carefully and see how Piero had worked. So, for example, we noticed that in the rosettes that he painted underneath the throne of the Virgin along the front step, he used a compass to outline each of the circles that he perfectly placed each rosette in. And we could see that because you could see the pinhole in the middle. Exactly. Yes.
Now, these are painted in oil?
The Williamstown painting seems to be a combination of oil and tempera.
This is the time when Italian artists are making the transition from tempera painting to oil. Mm-hmm. And he was a master of tempera because he painted frescoes.
Absolutely. And Piero is constantly pushing the boundaries of what any medium can do. And it's often reflected today in the condition of the painting. Oil and tempera together don't make a very happy mix over time. And it's one of the reasons that there are some condition problems, that the crackler you see in the surface of the Williamstown painting is in part a result of the experimental technique that Piero is using.
All of these subjects, the saints, the crucifixion, Madonna and Child, have been painted by other artists. What makes Piero's interpretation of them special?
That's a very difficult question.
If you know anything about Piero della Francesca, the minute you see them, you know that they're by Piero and not any other artist.
Piero has a wonderful sense of being able to create figures who should appear in a heavenly environment but are very much part of your present world, and yet they are not human. They have all the features of a human being, but yet you can tell that they're something else. One of my co-authors of the catalog, Machtel Israels, I thought put it very beautifully. She says these figures are heavenly distant but monumentally present. It gives you a sense of how he wanted the devotional viewer, the worshiper in front of an altarpiece, to be able to approach these figures, but also to stand away in a reverent distance.
His figures can be described as heavy-lidded. He's maybe the only artist who had that kind of look. Do we know why he developed that style?
you get a wonderful sense of it in the St. John the Evangelist figure at the Frick Collection. St. John the Evangelist is cast as an aged elderly man who's seen quite a lot of life, and you can see it in his gnarled hands and in his leathery skin on his face. Given what you see of his features, you expect that his body will be shriveled and emaciated, but in fact, instead of giving you an old man's body, Piero creates in the drapery that surrounds this figure these monumental and muscular folds, which instead of giving you a sense of the anatomy of the figure of St. John the Evangelist, speak to his monumentality and his gravity as and his importance as a pillar of the Christian Church.
Reviewers have suggested that seeing the show will create an impetus for people to go to Tuscany to see more of Piero's work. Do you have suggestions as where to go? You mentioned the legend of the True Cross in Arezzo.
Go to San Sepolcro. It is an absolute gem of a city. It's where you can find the Resurrection, a fresco by Piero della Francesca painted for the city town hall, which Aldous Huxley described in 1923 as the best picture in the world. Can't get much better than that. And you can also see there his intact, well, except for the frame, altarpiece for the Confraternity of the Virgin of Mercy, the famous standing virgin sheltering figures underneath.
Is it easy to get to San Sepolcro?
It's a bit of an adventure, and that's what makes it fun. It's about 25 miles southeast of Arezzo, which is already a little bit off the beaten track for most American travelers. But that's part of the excitement.
The show is on view until May 19th. Will it travel after that?
It won't. It's a single venue and only at the Frick.
And then one of the paintings goes back to Portugal. The other one goes back to Boston.
The paintings go back to Williamstown and to Washington. And unfortunately, the Frick will be the only venue.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Nathaniel. Silver is the curator who put the show together. If you're curious about the paintings and how the show looks, because it's in this wonderful oval room that is kind of the center of the Frick, where most of the special exhibits take place, you will get a sense of what the world was like for an artist like Piero della Francesca. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.